This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll take a look at how the use of criminal informants reflects an erosion of our justice system.
What people think goes on and what really goes on are two different things, as you'll see when we talk with Professor Alexandra Natapoff. We've got Paul Buell, co-editor with his comrade and companion Mary Jo Buell, of the just-published book, It Started in Wisconsin, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the New Labor Protest.
It all started in Wisconsin, and it's still going on in Wisconsin, and it's going on all over the country and the world.
We'll talk with one of the organizers of the May Day Workers' Rights and Immigrant Communities March in California.
May Day originated in Chicago in 1886, and now it's back in full force on both coasts and throughout the country, connected with immigrant rights and Occupy Wall Street.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, I understand we have a rare award to present.
Well, it's the tip of the Law and Disorder Hat Award to our friends and colleagues in Washington, D.C., Mara Verheyden-Hilliard and Carl Massinio of the Partnership for Civil Justice. And the award goes to them for the creative use of the Freedom of Information Act law. What they did was, when the Obama administration went down to the Latin American summit in Cartagena, the Secret Service preceded him. They sent down snipers and explosive experts and so on.
Their advance duties.
The advance team. And on our dime, this whole crew of Secret Service people went down to Cartagena. Usually these people are employed in preventing demonstrators from getting anywhere near the president. But this time they got there a little early, and what they did was they went to a bordello, and they ordered drinks poolside, stayed in luxury hotels, had a pretty good time. What Mara and Carl did was, through the Freedom of Information Act, was they asked for all the financial records on what these guys were doing and charging to the government so that we could pay for it. And what was particularly galling to Mara and Carl was that these are the people that not only keep demonstrators away from the president, but do this on taxpayers' money. So the Freedom of Information Act used again creatively. They did it the last time, 3 months ago, when the Occupy movement was shut down simultaneously in a number of cities across the country with the same tactics at the same time and blacked out by the media while they were doing it. And it was obvious that there was coordination in doing this, that the thing was coordinated by Homeland Security and the FBI. So Mara and Carl did a Freedom of Information Act request on the coordination of the shutdown of the Occupy movement. They've done it again with the Secret Service. Tip of the hat to Mara and Carl.
Well, we look forward to seeing the documents that are produced as a result of this.
The government's getting even more aggressive in its computer spying, isn't it?
Well, Michael, it seems as though every month or so we hear about a proposed new bill. And in fact, right now the government is considering a new law that would permit U.S. agents to spy on almost everything we do online. Microsoft and Facebook are supporting the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, or CISPA. It would permit companies doing business with the government to collect records of all of our online activities and then turn them over to the government without our knowledge. It wouldn't need a warrant. They wouldn't need legal justification. The bill essentially affords the government and corporations blanket immunity to protect them from being sued for violation of privacy or any other illegal actions in this process. Supporters of the bill claim that consumer information will be protected.
Sure.
But we know the reality is loopholes will render most of our activities vulnerable to spying, from our banking to our online shopping. Any information, private info that we've shared on the internet will be available to them. Michael, we've talked a lot about the prolonged use of solitary confinement, and one case that has really troubled humanitarians for decades was the Angola 3, and now it's the Angola 2.
Yeah, Robert King got out a few years ago. But two of the Black Panthers who've been in solitary confinement now, last week marks the 40th anniversary of Herman Wallace and Albert Woodfox being in solitary confinement in Angola Prison, the Farm, one of the most notorious prisons in America. There are 5,000 prisoners, mostly people of color, in that prison. These two men had formed a chapter of the Black Panther Party several years after they were put in prison, and a prison guard was murdered. There's no physical evidence linking the men to the murder. Nonetheless, they were tried and convicted on what's obviously political grounds, because they were Black Panthers, put into solitary confinement. They've been in solitary confinement now for 14,610 days. They're each locked in a windowless 6-by-9-foot cell. They're allowed to go out 3 times a week into a concrete play area to get some exercise, and they can get some visitors and some mail. But essentially, they're in there alone 23 hours a day. Human personalities deteriorate. People are social. That's why, both under U.S. law and international law, prolonged solitary confinement is considered cruel and inhuman treatment, really a form of torture.
In fact, Juan Mendez, the U.S. rapporteur for torture, has said that 25 days is really the limit that any human being should be subjected to this kind of confinement. It's like, Michael, being locked in your bathroom. As you said, Michael, we're social beings. This kind of solitary punishment amounts to torture.
Wallace gave an interview to a movie maker who produced a film which is going to be shown at the International Hot Docs Film Festival in Toronto. The film is called Herman's House, and in the film he said, "I have to spend a lot of time reading and writing. It helps me to maintain what little sanity I have left, to maintain humanity and dignity, to fight back to what people are trying to do to me." The film is about an imaginary house that Herman is constructing as an art project. An artist contacted him and said, if you could get out of there, what kind of house would you build for yourself? He sketches out ideas for the house, and he sends them to this artist, and it's really something. He wants to do something beautiful, so he has carnations and gardenias and tulips in the front yard. In the backyard, he has a swimming pool, and on the bottom of the swimming pool, there's a Black Panther made in tile. And he has a big bedroom, and right off the bedroom is a bathroom. And the bathroom has a bathtub that's 6-foot-by-9-foot square, same size as his solitary confinement cell. In any case, the movie is called Herman's House. Amnesty International is working on this. The two Panthers that are in prison are Herman Wallace and Albert Woodfox. Get a hold of Amnesty International on the net. They're collecting signatures. They've got 65,000 so far to pressure Bobby Jindal, the governor of Louisiana, to let these men out. They've been before 150 prison boards in the last 40 years, and the prison boards keep saying, send him back because of the original crime. So, folks, you can help out.
The FBI now spends more than $3 billion a year on counterterrorism, maintaining a team of 15,000 spies in its nationwide network of informants. The manner in which our criminal informant system operates is shrouded in secrecy and reflects fundamental flaws in our system of criminal justice. We talk today with professor of law and author Alexandra Natapoff about her book, Snitching, Criminal Informants and the Erosion of American Justice. Her book catalogs the downside in the use of snitches on social structure and democracy. Alexandra, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we are delighted to read your book, Snitching, Criminal Informants and the Erosion of American Justice, because it touches on a lot of themes that we've covered over the years on our program, namely the imbalance between government and the criminal justice system and some of the many, I think, really perversions of what occurs in real life. We wanted to start by talking about how the system of government informant works and some of the general problems that you've observed over the years.
Well, you're right to point out that this is an arena that touches on many, many issues in the criminal justice system, because snitching, as we often refer to it, or the use of criminal informants, is such a massive part of our criminal justice system, even though the public rarely gets a good look at it. It's a very secretive, sort of under-the-radar aspect of the way our criminal system handles investigations, the way it handles cases, the way it shapes our case law. So it really is a huge, if underappreciated and sort of underseen piece of how American justice functions and proceeds. The bottom line is criminal informants represent a deal. It's a deal between the government and a criminal suspect or defendant in which the government offers leniency, either the ability to walk away and avoid arrest or a shorter sentence or some other benefit, in exchange for information and cooperation. And it is such a powerful deal. It is a deal that exerts a huge amount of influence in plea bargaining. It produces a lot of information, of course, in the arena of terrorism and political informants, but also in millions of cases in the run-of-the-mill criminal justice system. It's a pervasive, everyday phenomenon. And unlike plea bargaining, in which eventually the public learns what the deal is and allegedly what the defendant did, informant deals take place under the radar. They may never come to light and to anyone's attention other than the handler and the suspect themselves. So the use of criminal informants is in tension with some pretty big principles of criminal justice, transparency, and treating like cases alike.
Now, you mentioned the term handler. Can you give us sort of a technical explanation of exactly how it works in terms of an FBI staff person being assigned to the informant?
You know, we can talk about some of the rules and regulations that govern the use of informants, but the reality is that this is a deeply under-regulated arena. So a handler is just the law enforcement official who creates and uses an informant. And it can be anybody. It can be the police officer talking to a street corner addict, cutting a deal right then and there. It can be an FBI agent who has an established, documented, supervised relationship with a long-term criminal informant. And it can be anything in between. We really vast discretion in police as well as prosecutors to create, use, and handle criminal informants. And it's an arena that, as I've written about, really deserves much greater attention and much more regulation.
Alexander, when you write about how the criminal justice system really works, what do you mean by that?
Somebody does something bad, and then the government goes after them, and then they get a case, and then either we litigate the case or they plead guilty with the assistance of counsel, and then they end up, turns out infrequently in this country, being released, or they garner a conviction. And I think what the use of criminal informants teaches us is that often that story is really misleading. Someone may be suspected of a crime or even just a person of interest to the government. And because the government has so many resources at its disposal, it can put a lot of pressure on people to cooperate, even people who haven't done anything wrong or anything what we would consider seriously criminal at all. So let me just use an example that happened in New York a couple of years ago. There's a young woman who was stopped in near Buffalo for driving on a suspended license. And the police officer who stopped her said threatened her that she was going to go to jail for her suspended license charge unless she became a drug informant. And the young woman said, I don't use drugs, I don't have any ties to the world of drugs. And the police officer said, that's okay. We will set you up. We'll send you to the Burger King where these deals take place, and we'll handle you. He was offering to become her handler with the background threat that she would go to jail if she didn't agree to enter into this world that was really not her world at all. And so she agreed. She was afraid of going to jail, and she signed an agreement to become a drug informant just like thousands of people do every year. And the only reason we know about it is because she went home and her father was an attorney, and he hit the roof and went to the police department and went to the city council and got his daughter's agreement rescinded. But that is a glimpse into the way the criminal system actually works, that people who have even mild brushes with the criminal system can end up, through this mechanism of criminal informing, entering into a world in which really anything can happen to them.
So I guess I had the perception that most informants were individuals in the criminal justice system, but you're saying that it could be someone who has a faint brush with the law and really isn't a veteran of the system and who's literally recruited.
Absolutely. Your impression is a function of the fact that we only keep track of the individuals who are already in the criminal system and have some documentation as to the deal that they made to become a cooperating informant. But there are many, many more people who will never show up in any document or on the public radar because they have these informal brushes with the law. So sociologists who study police practices on the street tell us that in their view, the majority of urban street criminals or people who have brushes with the criminal justice system are probably cooperating with and entering into deals like this with the police in some way. It's part of the law of survival on the streets. And again, we almost never see it because it's not the kind of thing that the criminal system requires that we document.
To play a devil's advocate for a second, Alexandra, but the cops will tell you, what do you want from us? How are we going to prosecute crimes? Often we don't see the crime happening. The only way we can do it is if we get an informant. So we're only trying to protect the public. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I think that is kind of the classic story. It's sort of an all or nothing model. Either you let us use informants in an unaccountable, invisible, secretive, undocumented way, or we can't run the criminal system at all. And what I argue in the book is that while there certainly are appropriate times when the government may want to cut a deal with a criminal defendant, we run this public policy in a disastrous way. We run it in a way that can harm vulnerable people who become informants without understanding their rights, without understanding that it may be dangerous to them. We permit the barter of crime under the radar in a way that is unfair to other defendants and other suspects. We produce unreliable information through the use of informants without regulation. So my contention is not that we should ban this practice, but that we should run it like any other major public policy, with transparency and accountability and some rules. My favorite criminal informant of sort of recent history is Jack Abramoff. Right? I think he's a great example of the debate that we should be having about criminal informants. Poster child for political corruption, right? Congress passed legislation because he was so representative of such heinous anti-democratic behavior. He was facing a sentence of up to 30 years for his collected crimes. He served 4 years because he agreed to cooperate, because he had an excellent attorney who negotiated a fantastic deal for him, and he's now out getting his life back together. And I think that reasonable minds could differ on whether that deal, that criminal informant deal with Jack Abramoff, produced a public good. You know, he gave the government information about some other people. We could bicker about whether, you know, one congressman and three administration aides is worth giving Jack Abramoff 4 years, or maybe that's the appropriate kind of deal to cut. But we don't even get to have that debate in our criminal system because those decisions are by and large delegated to individual police officers and individual prosecutors in a way the public will never know about.
In your book, you mention Mohammed Alansi, who helped the government investigate over 20 cases and then set himself on fire in front of the White House to protest his treatment by the FBI. I imagine there's a lot of coercion and abuse by the FBI and other government entities and manipulation of informants.
A very dramatic case, and usually we don't learn when informants have been mistreated because often they have very little power vis-a-vis the government and are unable to make their stories known in that way, certainly not in that dramatic way. But I would describe that case as in line with the story I told about the young woman in Attica. These are people who agree to become informants for a variety of reasons, and the government abuses its power with respect to people who are dependent on the government. We see story after story in the news these days of young people who agree to become informants and are harmed or even killed because their police handlers put them in dangerous situations. The arena of terrorism is a particularly high profile and important arena these days, and so we tend to learn when those informants are mistreated by or otherwise harmed by their government handlers. But it's a harm not limited to the terrorism arena. This is a danger that is built in to the authority that we give investigators, police, or the FBI, and prosecutors to negotiate in this way with any kind of criminal informant under the radar. And we should make it clear that the courts have approved these kinds of risks imposed on criminal informants. In effect, the court has said informants proceed at their own risk. This is a deal that they can enter into if they want to risk their life, if they want to risk their safety, if they want to risk their well-being. That is a deal that they can make on their own.
It's part of the course of doing business.
It's part of the course of doing business. And in effect, the law does not owe criminal informants much protection. And I think that's a big piece of the puzzle that we should look at, particularly for vulnerable informants, but informants across the board. Our criminal system is built on the principle that a defendant should not have to face the government unaided by counsel. And that's a principle, I think, that should be extended to criminal informants.
We're speaking with a law professor, Alexandra Nadipoff, who's written a book called Snitching, Criminal Informants and the Erosion of American Justice. It's got a wonderful cover, Alexandra. It's got a rat hanging upside down.
I'm going to have to give credit to NYU Press for that one. I can assure you I didn't think of that.
But let's talk about the erosion aspect. What kind of rules would you change? How do you protect people who get put in a position of having to be a rat?
You know, so we have this debate over almost every important aspect of our criminal justice system. When the court, I teach criminal procedure here at the law school, and so we just finished studying Miranda. And
that's the Loyola Law School in Los Angeles.
Loyola Law School in Los Angeles, that's right. And we all remember that when the court first decided Miranda, there was a great outcry. It's going to impede law enforcement. No one will ever get a confession again. It's going to be impossible to prosecute cases. We always hear the hue and cry every time we try to impose some transparency and accountability and protection for defendants and suspects in our criminal system. And then, of course, the disaster never occurs, and we have the largest criminal justice system on the planet, and we prosecute and convict more people than any other country. And so I think we need to have a dose of reality when we talk about regulating criminal informants the same way that we understand regulating the rest of the criminal system. There needs to be some mechanism by which police and prosecutors are bound by sensible guidelines in creating informants. So, for example, in Florida, just a few years ago, Florida passed a groundbreaking law. It's called Rachel's Law. And it was named after a young informant named Rachel Hoffman, who was a college graduate, young woman with a bright future. Caught with a small amount of drugs, police pressured her, as they do so many young people, into becoming an informant. They sent her on a dangerous sting, and she was killed. And her family, through their efforts, their lobbying, their dissent, got the Florida legislature to pass a law that requires Florida police not to stop using informants, not even to stop using any particular informant, but to create guidelines so that when police decide whether to, as we say, flip a suspect or a defendant, they have to consider some salient things. First, is this a young, vulnerable person? Do they have a substance abuse problem? Might they have a mental health issue that would pose risks to them if they became an informant? In other words, to require police to go through precisely the kind of rational process that we would hope they would go through anyway, in deciding whether a person should become an informant or not. And the thing to notice is that prior to Rachel's Law, there was no such requirement. Police didn't have to have these guidelines. There was no public accountability requirement that informants be created and used in any kind of accountable way.
Alexandra, you raise an interesting issue because we've talked a lot about terrorism cases in which the FBI seems to pursue actually vulnerable targets. So looking at someone who might be easily befriended by an agent because they needed help supporting their sick father, or maybe because they have a mental illness themselves. Now we're sort of looking at the profile of informants, and it would seem to me that it would make sense to have a stable informant that would increase reliability in terms of the information that the operative conveys to their handler. It would seem to be just a common sense public policy change to have some kind of standards for that.
You know, as you've said, the use of informants in the arena of terrorism ratchets up the concerns with the use of criminal informants more generally, because the stakes are so high, because the political stakes are so high, because they operate in an international arena, and of course it's an arena in which many lives can be affected. And so terrorism informants are not so different from criminal informants that we get to put them in another category. They are perhaps informants on steroids, if you will, just the most high-profile, extreme, important version of a problem that the criminal system grapples with every day in thousands of cases. And the question of who should become an informant, what kind of information from informants should the criminal system rely on, what sort of deals should we permit the government to cut with informants, these are core issues that affect not only our understanding of terrorism informants, but street corner addicts. The question of reliability and accountability, I think, are the two leading challenges for the use of informants, terrorism informants and other informants alike. Number one, is this informant so prone to fabrication, either because they're trying to work off their own offenses? Of course, in terrorism cases, we have often seen, for example, drug offenders turned terrorism informants as a way of working off their own extremely long drug sentences. So we have two concerns there. One, that that person themselves is subject to a large amount of pressure from the government because their own liberty, the rest of their life, may be on the line. How should we regulate that process? And number two, should we rely on information obtained through that very problematic relationship? And this is a question that plays itself out over and over again in the world of informant use.
You mentioned legislation in Florida. Is there a movement on the federal level to make any progress in this field?
Well, it's actually a very interesting and exciting time in the arena of informant reform. And I think that's as a result of a couple of trends. One is, over the past decade, we've just seen an increasing amount of attention paid to this issue, information that is newly public and available on this issue, and as a result, legislatures all over the country, federal as well as state, are starting to take up different facets of the question. A large part of this is due to the Innocence Movement, who has demonstrated that the use of criminal informants is a massive source of error in capital cases. There was a study a few years ago by Northwestern University Law School that concluded that over 45% of all the wrongful capital convictions that we know about are due to a lying criminal informant, making snitching the single largest source of error in U.S. capital cases. And so what that has done is flagged for legislators who are interested in the question of wrongful convictions and the Innocence Movement that criminal informant use is a subject long overdue for regulation. And so we've seen that in California, in Texas, in Illinois. States across the country are starting to impose greater restrictions on the use of criminal informants, and in particular jailhouse snitches, as a way of improving the reliability of information garnered from those sources. Florida is the only state so far to actually require police to create regulations for all informant use and creation. But at the federal level, we see new legislation that is currently pending before Congress. It's called the Confidential Informant Accountability Act of 2012, is introduced by Congressman Stephen Lynch from Massachusetts, and it would require all federal agencies, federal investigative agencies like the FBI, but also the DEA and the Secret Service and ICE, to report to Congress every 6 months all the crimes committed by their confidential informant. Which reminds us that at this point, when crimes are committed by confidential informants, there's no mechanism that requires those agencies to disclose that fact to anybody.
You've talked about wide latitude that handlers are given, and we didn't really touch on the issue of allowing snitches, informants, to commit criminal acts during the course of their duties, which I understand is a huge problem.
It's a huge problem, and it's in the nature of the deal itself.
Right.
The deal in exchange for information and cooperation, by definition, requires the government to tolerate informant crime. And one of the things that the government doesn't keep track of, is not required to keep track of, and therefore we don't know, is how many crimes are committed by criminal informants in the pursuit of creating and investigating new cases.
And could this include a homicide?
We know that it includes homicides. We know that criminal informants commit some of the most heinous sorts of crimes. The FBI has grappled with this for decades with its mafia informants. It's the reason that the Department of Justice has the guidelines today that it does, because FBI informants were permitted to commit such heinous crimes. And so that really gets to the heart of the compromise. Not only are we permitting the government to pressure suspects, often without counsel, to risk their lives and well-being to cooperate. Not only are we using often very unreliable information in cases that come from criminal informants, but we are forgiving informant crime under the table, off the radar, every day. And our criminal system isn't supposed to do that. The public is supposed to know when people commit and are prosecuted for those crimes, and in effect, criminal informants are the massive loophole and exception to almost every principle that we have.
We've been speaking with law professor Alexandra Nadipoff, who wrote Snitching, Criminal Informants and the Erosion of American Justice. Alexandra, when you got out of law school, what was it that led you ultimately to write this really intelligent, original book?
I'm going to blame it on a 12-year-old that I met in Baltimore. I had a fellowship with the Open Society Institute to do community legal work in Baltimore. And as part of that fellowship, I used to teach classes in the evening at community centers about law and constitutional law and rights and things of that nature. And during one of these classes, a 12-year-old raised his hand and he said, "Okay, I got a question. Police let dealers stay on the corner because they're snitching. Is that legal? I mean, can the police do that?" And after I recovered from the question and explained to him and his young friends, 12, 13 years old, that yes, police can do that, and it's legal for police to permit offenders to remain on the neighborhood street corner in sight of these young people if the police think that they are useful to them. The kids were disgusted. They said, "Well, the police aren't doing their jobs, and so all you got to do is snitch and you can keep on dealing." And it was that moment that I saw the use of criminal informants was not just a niche criminal justice policy or a way of getting information or handling cases. It was really affecting sort of the social and political and legal experiences of people in high crime communities, that young people were learning a terrible lesson that justice is for sale and that deals can be made right there on street corners in ways that threaten their own well-being. And I've been fascinated by it ever since.
Well, we are so grateful to that 12-year-old because you've rendered a really critical piece of work, and your commitment to this subject matter is something that heartens us greatly on Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Multi-day occupation of the Wisconsin State Capitol last winter by tens of thousands of people? Remember the massive demonstrations that erupted when the right-wing Republican Governor Scott Walker proposed to dismantle public unions in the state of Wisconsin? These protests became the largest labor demonstrations in modern American history. We're joined today by Paul Buell, the historian and co-editor of the book, It Started in Wisconsin, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the New Labor Protest. It's a powerful collection of eyewitness reports, essays, cartoons, photographs, with an afterword by Michael Moore and a foreword by John Nichols. It Started in Wisconsin is an important contribution to the movement as it's growing today. We're delighted to have Paul Buell back on the show. Paul, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Paul, we're talking to you in Madison, Wisconsin. Your adopted town. I know that you're from Illinois, but you went to graduate school in the late 60s and 70s in Madison.
That's right.
You retired, you and Mary Joel, your co-editor of It Started in Wisconsin, when you and Mary Joel retired from Brown, you retired in Madison, and I can't help but think you had exquisite timing because you were there for all the fireworks last year, and you and Mary Jo have done this wonderful book. It Started in Wisconsin, a Verso book. It's introduced by John Nichols with an afterword by Michael Moore, and the book is called It Started in Wisconsin, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the New Labor Protest. So let me start off by asking you, Paul, when you say It Started in Wisconsin, what's it?
Well, I think this is the question we've been pondering since that we agreed to have that as a title, or perhaps even proposed it, because the it is very large and perhaps vaporous, but on the other hand, perhaps tremendously promising. I suppose we were thinking about Occupy in the sense that Madisonians and people from elsewhere in Wisconsin and labor supporters from as far away as California occupied the state capitol, the rotunda, very close to the bust of Robert M. La Follette in February of last year and remained there for some weeks. So that we have the idea that if Occupy was launched in many places, of course, including Tahrir Square in Cairo, nevertheless, in terms of the U.S., the it may mean Occupy, or you can say it another way, that it may mean the emergence of a new kind of movement.
Let's cross our fingers and hope. But the provocation in Wisconsin, the inspiration might have come from Tahrir Square in Egypt, but the provocation came from the ultra-right Governor Scott Walker. Tell us what Walker did and what the reaction was.
Well, in brief, and really accounting for things that were done in his first months of office, beginning in February of last year until the legislative session just recently concluded, adds up to quite a wallop against all the progress made in the
20th century. He said he dropped a bomb.
And the bomb was basically, if by no means only, taking away the right of public employees, state employees, to have unions, something that had been put into law in 1959 by bipartisan support and had been maintained through five decades without serious resistance from Republicans, many of whom were on school boards and other government agencies and had thought that unions offered a reasonable way to deal with conflicts, problems, and the tasks before all public servants. So knowing what we know about ALEC, the agency that writes these legislative bills, we should have suspected that it was coming, but basically we didn't, or we were deluded because Walker, in running for election, never mentioned these promises or threats at all and made some public statements on getting along with unions in Milwaukee when he was a county executive. So that was a stunning shock, and the response was just as stunning as the shock. That is to say, a mass outpouring that really sort of began with students in Stoughton, an old Norwegian community about half an hour south of Madison, working up their own protest with Facebook to support their teachers, and then in that following week and weeks, a massive outpouring of people around the Capitol and then occupying the Capitol. Things went on and on to the point where there were crowds of 150,000 in a town, Madison, that has only 200,000 normal residents, and in one way or another have continued on until today.
It was really quite extraordinary, taking over the Capitol, having farmers drive their tractors down to Madison in the snow. My sister was standing out in front of the Capitol for many days with a sign referencing Scott Walker that said, "Impeach the heartless bastard."
I think one of the most amazing things that for Pacifica radio listeners is, you know, Pacifica has been in the business since the late 1940s in the Bay Area in providing the documentation that other commercial radio stations rarely provide, and that newspapers, until the era of underground newspapers and after, not so much, until the blogosphere, were recording. Now, I'd say these Wisconsin demonstrations, and not only in Madison, are probably the most recorded mass movement of the left in recent history, perhaps anything else that comes to mind, simply because there were so many wonderful photographers, so many videographers, so many other kinds of collage artists, et cetera, providing an endless outpouring of material that really is quite accessible on YouTube and through websites. And your listeners who want to find it will find their way to it. But in looking at those things, especially I think the YouTubes with music and demonstrations, they can sort of vicariously live within that moment and get a much better sense of what's going on than I can easily say. Then again, the book, It Started in Wisconsin, is awfully helpful.
Not only is helpful, I think it really is required reading for people in the movement today, because it lays it all out. And not only how and why it started in Wisconsin, but talks about the right-wing assault that's going on not just in Wisconsin.
Right.
And talks about the fight. It begins bringing in the labor movement and then what we do beyond. And I wanted to ask you, with respect to bringing in the labor movement, there was a lot of militant activity by unions that were predominantly women, weren't there?
I would say among the most important developments in this, relative to other stories within the history of labor, the unions of public workers are substantially, if not overwhelmingly, women. So the shape of the movement, perhaps its cultural character, perhaps the infernal degree of politeness that outsiders frequently complained about, people chanting outside the Capitol, let us in, please, and chanting when the firefighters supporting us came by, thank you, that sort of thing. There's a whole range of manifestations that could be described as gender influenced, but at any rate, what it demonstrated is that women in the labor movement were ferociously militant, and the massive support for them probably also demonstrated the number of husbands, fathers, sons, grandchildren, and others who saw in those union workers, state workers, the defense of all of the range of decent things that need to be done in society, between education, care for the poor, the elderly, and so forth, and the protection of the air, the water, and all those things which came out of progressive era reforms a century ago, and often were first launched by women's reform groups.
Paul, let me ask you something. I may jump ahead of Michael, but I'm not sure. But from outside, as we followed what was going on in Wisconsin, or we have a lot of friends who were there, there was a decision made at some point to go and try and recall some of the legislators. And of course, now we'll talk in a few minutes about the recall campaign on the governor. From looking at it from New York, I said to myself, well, is that really a good idea to channel this into a recall campaign, or shouldn't they be moving toward more of a mass strike or something like that? And I'd just like your political perspective on that.
Well, it's probably the most vexing or at least complex of all of the issues that we've faced and will continue to be discussed. My assessment is that the labor movement was in no way prepared to stage a general strike, nor would a massive walkout of public workers mean that the wheels of industry would stop, what few wheels there are still here
left,
with the abandonment. So the sense that public workers wish to put pressure on the political system, something which is deep in the history of AFSCME, among other unions, was seen as the predominant majority, at least, view of the way to go. And there's something else that I've tried to write about after that, that's interesting and fascinating, and that is that contrary to our expectations of the Democratic Party in general, assorted leaders, not at all necessarily the foremost leaders, were quite wonderful in their constituencies and the things that they did and how they related to the movements and so forth. And to me, it was almost like a revival of the CIO era Democratic Party progressives of the 1930s and 1940s. They just didn't act like the Democrats that we recognize. And they didn't act like the Democrats who, in state government since the 1970s, have made one concession after another to manufacturers who are about to leave the state anyway, and so on. So in a very strange way, it revives something that we haven't seen since probably the dissolution of the Progressive Party in the early 1940s. And you still hear people sing, we need a real progressive party to make the people free, or people holding up signs with Bob La Follette, Progressive Party. So there's a sense that we need a new political party, but at the moment it's channeled through Democratic Party operations.
Now, I think for me, what you said, I was actually just thinking about this today and talking to someone else. There wasn't a preparation and the necessary for a general strike, and probably the worst thing that could have happened would have been a failure.
Well, that's right, and it would appear in retrospect that such a failure was more than likely.
Let me jump you ahead to where we are today.
Yep.
So today, there were a million signatures gotten on a recall petition against Governor Walker, and I think probably our listeners don't know much more than that. Is there a date when that's going to happen? Is there money pouring into the campaign? What are your expectations? Is there political organizing going on? What's happening?
Well, of course, we're very fretful as well as being very hopeful. Let me start with a wedding photographer in Fort Atkinson, a woman named Lori Compass, who decided to run against one of the Fitzgerald brothers, one of the most powerful of the right-wing clique in office, from a district that was considered conservative. The Democrats told her it was hopeless. The unions told her it was hopeless. But gathering around her friends, she got the necessary signatures to call for this crook's recall, and now she's waging a vigorous campaign against him. Those campaigns will come up, we think, in the first week of June or a little bit after. Before then, in the first week of May, there will be the primaries, including, we just learned, a quote-unquote Lincoln La Follette progressive Republican running against Governor Walker in the Republican primary.
Good for him. Paul, we're going to be able to welcome you to the Breck Forum April 27th. That's a Friday night at 7:30, when you're going to be in New York City from Madison to talk about your book, It Started in Wisconsin.
That's right, and joining me will be several people from Occupy Comet. As a editor or producer of Radical Comics, I'm always interested in new developments in the field, and I think it's quite exciting that there are young comic artists who are working in and around Occupy. So all in all, it should be quite an interesting evening.
No, absolutely. It's on the 27th of April at the Breck Forum. It's a Friday night at 7:30. Paul will be there with the Occupy Comics people. There are comics in the book. There are wonderful photographs in the book. There are great essays. There's an afterword by Michael Moore and an introduction by John Nichols. The book is called It Started in Wisconsin. It's edited by Mary Jo Buell and Paul Buell, and everybody should have this book. We talked about the Occupy book a couple of weeks ago on the show. This is the companion volume. This is where it's at politically these days. Published by Verso in New York City. It started in Wisconsin. Paul, thank you very much, and convey our thanks to Mary Jo for your good work on this, and we look forward to seeing you when you get to New York. And thanks for being on the show.
Maybe we'll have a next governor next time we talk to you.
We hope.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
In a revival of the great American tradition of protesting on May 1st, May Day, in the past years, public employees, workers, immigrants, students, and many others around the country have rallied to hold on to their collective bargaining rights, their workers' rights, their pensions. May Day protests this year will emphasize these issues and will be especially significant for immigrants' rights in California and New York that directly affect those communities. We talk today with Selena Benitez, director of the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador. Selena is also with the Southern California Immigration Coalition and produces the radio show Suplemento Comunitario on our sister station KPFK in Los Angeles. Selena, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me here.
You know, May Day was originally an American holiday. It goes back to 1886 in Chicago when workers were demonstrating for an eight-hour day. But after the Russian Revolution, it really became a kind of an international workers' holiday and was kind of eclipsed in our own country. And in fact, in the 50s, it was kind of pushed aside, and May 1st was renamed Law Day. But it's kind of gaining American prominence again, particularly in the immigrant community, with these enormous demonstrations over the last couple of years. Tell me, what are you doing in organizing for May Day out in Los Angeles?
Well, for May Day, what we're doing is a massive march. A lot of people are definitely going to come out, such as from the unions, students, you know, women groups, but also a lot of the immigrant leaders are going to come out. For our organization, the Southern California Immigration Coalition, we don't see a difference between working rights and immigrant rights. So we're strongly making demands to be heard, but also like focusing on the fact that there's been a lot of deportations. Over 1 million deportations have taken place, and it seems like nobody's doing anything about it. These are people that are hardworking people that pay taxes, but then yet their human rights continue to be violated. So we have approximately 5 demands that are going to come from May 1st, which is full legalization, stop the ICE raids, no guest worker programs, workers' rights to organize, and driver license for all. And this call is not just being done in LA, but also across California, and even some of the other our sister organizations in New York will also be participating in making those calls and demands for people to be aware that they have rights, and we need to start demanding for our rights to be protected.
What kind of response do you expect from the police? Because I know in 2007 there was a police melee where they attacked many protesters.
For the past few years, even after that big attack, we have been meeting with the police officers, and we have made it clear that our security will take care of the different problems and they shouldn't interfere. So in the past year, it has been dealt with that. We actually have meeting with the LAPD, the various groups that are calling from the different marches, and it's pretty much in a sense of like, you need to respect the people provide their own security, and they'll take care of like little incidents here and there. They're minor, but definitely they're keeping their distance to make sure that it does not continue to repeat.
Selena, how did you get involved with the movement, and particularly with CSPES out in Los Angeles?
I was a student activist. I was student body president for Los Angeles City College, and I started realizing that there's a lot of information that people were not receiving either. You know, even when you went to college, you were still not receiving a lot of information when it came to the involvement of the United States with other countries, but also how people were active in the United States helping other countries. So I started like researching, and in my research, I ran into CSPES, and they were taking a delegation to El Salvador, and I got, I'm Salvadorian, but yet I didn't know a lot about my culture or history. And so I went on the delegation, I got to meet with a lot of people, and also found out the rich story about an organization that had been around for 30 years, helping out El Salvador, but also their causes when it came to human rights, but also taking a stand against the government when it came to the unjust practice they were doing. So that's how I got involved with CSPES, and I've definitely gone to El Salvador and various countries to observe elections, human rights, but also help organize people here to continue to be aware of how our tax dollars are being used, and not just here locally to oppress people, but also like in other countries, and how our laws are definitely just not affecting people here, but also internationally.
In your organizing of the demonstration on May 1st in Los Angeles, are you involved with the Occupy Wall Street movement?
The Occupy LA movement is going to be marching with the Southern California Immigration Coalition. So we are going to, they are going to be meeting us at 4 p.m. They're going to join our march. They're doing a 4 wing, so they're coming from different directions. They're going to be meeting in downtown LA, and they'll go ahead and join our march. So we're centralized where the march is at, since we have been doing this march for quite a few years now, so there was a link between both organizations, and the demands are there, you know, for fair and just treatment of workers.
Do you expect a lot of students to turn out on May Day?
Actually, we do. We have been working a lot with not just college students, but also high school students that have come out in the various marches. So we have a good group of high school students that are going to be coming up from different parts of the cities. You know, we have been working with UTLA, the teachers' union, so we're going to be able to provide buses for them to come from various locations. You know, the East LA, you know, from South Central, from two different high schools, they're going to be coming out, and also from the Valley as well. But we've gotten a lot of high school and college students' response that they want to join, and they're already working and, you know, recruiting even more students to come out along with their parents and other family members. So student, you know, outreach has been very important from, you know, high school all the way through college.
Well, Selena Benitez, what you're doing out in Los Angeles, I think, is going to be echoed in communities all across the country. And it's a thrill for us to hear what you're doing across the continent. We wish you every success. We'll be in touch with you because we'd like to hear more about the movement out in Los Angeles and about the work that you do on our sister station, KPFK in Los Angeles. Selena Benitez, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Making games. It used to be when a man got hot that he could always